Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by looking back on fondly remembered films. I am Robert Johnson, and I'm here with my fellow Victorian-era master cracksman, Chris Webb.
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year to you!
Or as they say in America, Happy New Year!
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year! Yeah, so we do have American listeners, so I thought we'd say a little special hello to them.
And hello to all two, or hopefully three of you.
I think there's two. There are three, actually.
Hello, American listeners.
Hello, America.
And welcome to 2018.
Yes.
First podcast of the year.
Yep.
So, Chris, this was your choice today. What do we have?
I've chosen a heist caper made in 1978, directed by Michael Crichton, starring Sean Connery and Donald Sutherland, and it is The First Great Train Robbery.
Wow, The First Great Train Robbery.
The First Great Train Robbery, also known as The Great Train Robbery. It had a different name in the UK. I think Michael Crichton's book was called The Great Train Robbery, and when he produced it, it was called The Great Train Robbery, but because of Ronnie Biggs and Buster Edwards, it had to be called The First Great Train Robbery in case there was any confusion and you ended up going to see Phil Collins when was that?
Ah, fantastic. And so when did you first see this as a nipper?
This was one of those films that was always on ITV on a Sunday afternoon when I was a kid. It would be on once or twice a year. Always great fun to tune into. I think everybody loves a caper movie or a heist movie where you're cheering on the baddies and the thieves, and this is no exception. I must have seen it probably four or five times when I was a kid. I hasten to add, what I did see was the ITV Sunday afternoon version, which of course would have been slightly edited.
Bit of censorship?
Yes.
Censorship?
It's a bit of censorship. So watching this for the first time, watching this now, it's the first time I've seen the unedited version. And there were a few scenes and a few lines in there that surprised me a little bit.
Yeah, there's some really good James Bond quality double entendres, actually.
Oh, some of it makes Two and a Half Men sound subtle.
Fantastic. Yeah, I've never seen this. I remember it being on the telly sort of on Sunday nights and things, and, and never watched it. Quite interesting to see that it was directed by Michael Crichton from a novel of his, which was apparently a best-selling novel in 1975. Okay. Because for me, I associate Michael Crichton with kind of the techno thriller.
Yeah, it's science gone wrong, isn't it?
Science gone wrong.
Technology runs amok is Michael Crichton.
Andromeda Strain, Jurassic Park, obviously, Westworld, which he
also directed,
wrote and directed.
Like Disclosure, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's all about the misuse or the errors of technology.
And good with sort of action as well. Yeah, Coma, it was another
good
one.
That's good.
And of course, one of Tom Selleck's best forays into cinema, Runaway.
Which he also directed, I believe.
Yeah. And Gene Simmons is the baddie.
What, from Kiss?
He is, I think.
Oh, okay.
Is he?
So not the one from Spartacus, no? Not the woman from Spartacus?
No. Not late Gene Simmons.
Not late Gene Simmons.
Yeah, so it was, I was quite interested to see that. A little slight change of genre.
I did see that the book, I think, is a lot more factual, because there was an actual Great Train Robbery with characters of the characters are all real people.
Great Gold Robbery of 1885.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So I think the book is a lot more kind of factual, but I believe that when he adapted it into a screenplay, he tried to make it a bit more farcical. He wanted to make it more of a farce, and boy did he.
Yeah, and I think he just slightly changed some names so that he wasn't totally bound to historical fact, but apparently became aware of it when he was lecturing at Cambridge University.
Okay, that's interesting.
And thought, I'll just rattle off a best-selling novel about this. And
just not one off.
Yeah.
Easy.
Just rub one out, and so he did. Interesting film. Very interesting film.
Yeah. So as the cast in the lead, we have Sean Connery as Edward Pierce. Now, I was reading that Sean Connery was 47 when he made this. Which is the same age as me. I'm going to be 47 very soon. And some of the stuff that he does in this, there's no way on earth I could ever do. Like running across trains, essentially.
Yeah.
Because he did a lot of the stunts himself. I think he spent about a week riding, like walking on the back of a train.
Yeah.
I just get out of breath getting on a train.
I was quite impressed with those scenes as well.
You can tell it's him.
You can tell it's him. Definite, you know, some stunt work, hanging off the side of a train. It's not quite Tom Cruise clinging to a plane as it's taking off in a Mission Impossible sequel, but does look pretty scary and
some of those
real.
Tunnels are incredibly close to his head, and he's not looking.
And he's not a small man.
No, either. He's a tall chap.
Nearly would have lost his terrible hairpiece.
Can we talk about the hairpiece now? Let's get it out of the way.
It's just, you know, this is a man who has built a lot of his career on hairpieces. Sean Connery, and this has got to be the worst of the lot.
Yeah, we all know Sean Connery wears a rug in everything since probably Goldfinger, and he's not shy about it. But this one, it's a strange haircut.
Yeah,
and it doesn't even match the beard. It's a different shade. It's a different sort of hair structure, if you like.
It's a weird center-parted, floppy, mousy blonde. It's almost something like Michael York should be wearing.
Howard.
Well, yeah, it just did not go with.
It may as well have a chin strap on it. It's such an obvious tube.
And then his beard is sort of 9 shades darker.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Like Grecian 2000 beard. It reminds me of the scene in The Last Jedi when Mark Hamill comes back as Luke Skywalker at the end, and he's sort of dyed his hair and made to look a bit younger. Yeah, it was a bad, bad hairpiece.
Yes.
But, you know, the rest of the costuming, the sets, the locations, the period detail for the rest of the film is really, really good.
I think the production on this is awesome. Mm. I think a lot of it was filmed in... It was filmed in London. I think some of the exteriors were filmed in Ireland.
Okay, yeah.
A lot of the old houses in Dublin, I think, were used. We were sort of doubled up, like the banks and the exteriors of some of the posh houses were actually in Dublin.
Yeah.
But it looks fabulous.
It looks really great. Good. Yeah, so other than... I don't know what was going on with wardrobe and the Connery hair department... and other than Donald Sutherland's terrible English accent...
Is he meant to be English? Because I thought he was Irish, or...
I don't know. I just thought, you know, I wrote down he went to the Kevin Costner school of sort of British accents here anyway.
Because all it needs is a line of dialogue to go, hey, you're American, and he can just be Donald Sutherland, or you hire an English actor.
Yeah. Unforgivably bad.
What do you think about the rest of his performance? If you can get past the accent.
I was expecting more from the character. Considering Donald Sutherland was cast, you know, fine. But kind of really understated introduction for the character. He just kind of like appears in the movie.
Yeah, that's right.
Sort of, oh, okay, you're recruited now.
Yes.
And a couple of decent moments, but they could have cast anyone really in that role.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Obviously, it was to secure funding. He was probably pretty hot off the back of things like MASH and other major hits throughout the 70s. So he was probably as hot as Connery at the time.
Yeah, but it's really the Sean show, isn't it?
I mean, oh, absolutely.
The whole movie is Sean Connery-centric.
Thankfully, he's really good at it.
Thankfully, he's brilliant in it. And but I was disappointed with the Donald Sutherland character because I just thought, wow, yeah.
I think the unsung hero is Leslie Ann Down.
She's great.
She's awesome.
She is great.
She's another of my little childhood crushes, probably from this film, Leslie Ann Down. I've always been in love with her.
I had a little childhood crush on her as well. I think it's from the North and South miniseries.
Possibly, yeah.
Was when I first, for some reason, I just remembered the name.
It's all the period corsets and bustiers and stuff like that. And the fact that she's lovely. And she's also incredibly talented, which she proves this because she's like the master of disguise in this. She will disguise herself as a lady of the night, as a young boy.
Yeah.
Various costumes that she wears throughout. So she should have had more screen time in this.
She should have. And as I was watching it, I was actually thinking, possibly because Sean Connery almost plays this as a Victorian era James Bond on a mission, I was just thinking she would have been such a great Bond girl.
I agree.
Because she's got that, you know, the smarts, the femme fatale sort of aspect, and she's gorgeous, and she can act, and she's got good comic timing. Yes. She could have been the goody one or the baddie one.
Absolutely.
That's probably comes across as quite a misogynistic, patronising thing to say. You're so good, you could have been a Bond girl.
You could have been a model if you'd really wanted.
You're so good looking, you could have been a waitress.
But she could have been a revolutionary Bond girl who would have matched Bond easily.
Exactly. She could have been like Eva Green's.
Yes, who I know you're a fan of.
Love Eva. Love Eva Green.
Eva's Green's, yeah.
So that's kind of our central cast, really. Mm.
So I thought the film started in a really interesting way. Before we get any action, before we get any titles, we get the voiceover.
You know what this reminded me of?
In sepia. Go on, tell me.
It reminded me of, I thought we're back in Highlander territory again.
Yeah.
Well, is Sean recording this from the shitter in his Spanish villa? Or?
He's in the Gary Glitter in Marbella. Yeah. But I thought it was, I didn't know if it was lazy or if it was bold to do it this way, because pre-credits, we get the voiceover that says, there's Crimea Young Gold that's shipped, goes on a train to Folkestone, shipped to France, and goes out to the Crimea. £25,000 almost every week.
Mm-hmm.
There's a safe on there, the keys are hidden, and they tell us exactly where these keys are.
Yeah.
Now, that dialogue normally happens about 20 or 30 minutes into a heist movie where they say, right, this is why I've got you all together.
Mm-hmm.
So to do it before we even get the opening credits, like I said, I don't know if it's lazy or if it's intentionally setting the pace. It says, this is what it's about, and this is what we're going to do. This is what the film is going to be about.
Yeah, I wondered if it was a, they chickened out after a screening, and people said it's a bit complicated or a bit hard to follow. But that's the beauty of sort of heist caper films. I love being in a heist caper film where, in that first act, you're sort of going,
Who's after what? What are they doing?
Gee, I needed to take notes on that previous
Absolutely.
Scene.
Absolutely.
You know, I quite like that feeling of being outsmarted by a film.
Yeah.
And then when it kind of makes sense towards the end, you feel kind of...
You feel satisfied with yourself.
I worked that out. And even if you don't work it out and you rewatch it. But, so it had that tacked-on feeling, didn't it? Because it was even kind of like this portentous...
It was in sepia.
You know, in 1885, England and France were at war with Russia. I mean, it totally was not in the tone of the rest of the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
I sort of tend to think it was probably tacked on.
Mm. And there wasn't time for a reshoot with Sean actually delivering it at page 20 of the script, perhaps.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't explain to Agar, Donald Sutherland, what he's doing for till about halfway through the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He wants him to get the keys and to copy the keys, but he doesn't tell him why.
Yeah, it was a funny one, and it did rob us, of course, of our opening scene being Michael Elphick.
Yeah,
having a scrap on a train with a whole bunch of distressed chickens.
Yeah. Some of them fall out of a moving train. Yeah. My heart went out to those chickens.
Yeah, there's an Aardman film there, actually, about those chickens.
Chicken, run!
And then quite grimly just tossing the guy out of the...
Chucks him out of the train.
I sort of expected him to dust off his... You know, some hay and just sort of get on his merry way, twirl his moustache, but he just
lies. But then to be run over by a horse and like in the Naked Gun or something.
And then he's just lying there with blood dripping down his ear.
So of course then Sean Connery, Edward Pierce and Miriam turn up.
Yeah.
He takes one look at the dead body and she says, is he dead?
Mm. I love that scene.
Yeah. So we're led to assume that he was Connery's right-hand man.
Yeah.
And he just thought, well, he'd try and get on the train and nick the gold as a sort of smash and grab, and it didn't work. So his plan has failed.
Mm-hmm.
But with regards to the introductory voiceover, I suppose we should explain what the film is about.
Yeah.
Which is basically, as we said, the Crimean War's on, and so Crimean gold is shipped out via Folkestone. It goes on a train from London to Folkestone, then takes a boat to France, and then it goes out to the front. And their idea is to steal the gold from the safes on the train, on a moving train. It's never been done before.
So there's a monthly shipment of gold, and it's payment for the soldiers, isn't it? Mm. They're paying the British soldiers and the gold. Yeah.
Yeah. But to open the safe, there are four keys.
Yep.
And two safes, four keys.
Yep.
And the originals of those keys are stashed away in various parts of the city. One is held by the bank manager. Another one is held by an executive of the bank.
Yeah.
And the other two are just kept in a cabinet at the train station.
Mm.
Why two in the same place?
Not sure.
Could they not think of just hiding one down the back of the sofa, under the welcome mat or something?
Yeah.
There's no need for there to be two, other than taking the time when they're actually copying them. That's the only real reason why I could see that.
And I'm not sure, was that part of what actually happened?
I think there were three keys that they had to sort of go and steal and copy. The imprinting them on wax all did happen. Agar was responsible for all of that in real life.
Mm.
So that's the plan. It's never been done before, but Edward Pierce is your man to do it.
Yes. Never, important to note, never has there been a robbery of a moving train at this point.
Probably like wallets taken or
you
know, stealing somebody's, I don't know, hat or something, but not of gold or money. Not a heist.
So even at this point, there weren't sort of, in the wild, wild west, there weren't banditos Like,
they always held up a train.
They held up
it's
a train.
Never been on a moving.
Never been. Ah, yes, of you course. See? They stop the train.
Yeah.
You're good.
They do. Thank you very much. I just thought of that. That's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the thing that then puzzles me is we get the big voiceover, which we've talked about, and then we go to like a gentleman's club where we're told the same thing exactly the same by one of the men who holds the keys.
Which sort of lends to it being tacked on.
Yeah.
A tacked on scene at the start, doesn't it? Lovely set of the gentleman's club.
There's some familiar faces in there.
Yeah, there are.
There's Donald Hewlett from An Ain't Half Hot Mum, who plays one of the officers within An Ain't Half Hot Mum. Also, Peter Butterworth from the Carry On films
is
sat there. Yeah. You'd recognise him in things like Carry On Doctor. He's the one with the funny face. He sometimes has a big growth on his lap and they all pat it and he goes, "Ooh!" Or, "I thought I was going to break wind. I'm afraid I was wrong." That's him. So it's fun. I think it was his last film. So he doesn't have any lines, but there's a lot of old men talking about women getting the vote.
Yeah, there's quite a good little bit of satire there about society's sort of going to hell. And what do you expect when 1 in 7 men have the vote?
Yeah.
Ordinary shopkeepers can vote. And it would be women soon.
But it is effectively a scene about hubris. There's the men talking about the world's going to rack and ruin if we give women the vote. So they're these men who are comfortable and confident in their lot without realising the world is changing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have, oh God, what's his name? The guy who's doing the story, who's the bank executive.
Fowler.
He basically reveals to everyone where the keys are.
Yeah.
He just sits there going, "There's one with Kent, I have one around my neck, which I never take off, and the other two were at the train station." Mm. And of course, one of the gentlemen sitting around there, very poorly lighting a cigar, he's lighting it, and you notice the flame doesn't touch the cigar when he's lighting it, is Edward Pierce, Sean Connery, who asks all the right questions about where are the keys, but he's confident that the money is safe. And he says, "Thank God for that," and he sits down.
Sort of in the next scene, we learn that he's actually posing as a successful sort of society businessman.
Yes.
And this is a really great scene because Sean Connery's lying shirtless in a bed eating grapes.
Yes.
And the actual eating of the grapes seems to just emphasise his particular Connery kind of lisp, or I don't know what you call it, his particular way of talking.
Yeah.
Even more.
His impediment.
Yes. Yeah, I've made something of myself. Yeah. Like, is that a grape there, or is that just, this is when Leslie Ann Down looking very fetching and...
In her corset and
her stockings. And she's very kind of quickly co-opted, I guess, into the
so
plot.
We then get the first in a very long line of knob gags. Where she's saying, "Oh, I can tell it excites you," when she crawls in the bed. And the expression on his face, he kind of grunts and shuffles when she says that.
Yeah.
It's like he's just shat the bed.
And then he sort of does this 500-yard stare, kind of like...
Yeah.
It's like, ooh.
You sure, love? Yeah. She's been recruited for the heist.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is he recruits Donald Sutherland, who called Agar, who we first see him when he does this quite little nifty pickpocketing act on a lady with three of his companions. One of which is Nick Cotton from EastEnders.
Oh,
the one who actually does the snatch in the hat is Nasty Nick from EastEnders.
Yeah,
you expect him to go, "Hello, Mark, got a fiver." But he doesn't. But maybe this is what led to his life of crime in Albert Square.
Yeah.
Pickpocketing with Donald Sutherland. But it's a nice lift, which they then spoil by showing it again to show how they did it.
Mm. Wonder if this was Crichton's kind of relative inexperience as a director as well.
Possibly. But we have to remember this is also pre-video.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't have a chance to go back and play it again to watch the lift. You would watch it and you would go home. So you may possibly have missed it. This scene really reminded me of Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
There's an identical scene on the Chicago train where Matt Damon does some pickpocketing and then George Clooney goes over and says, like, "Oh, nice lift." And this is exactly what happens here.
Yeah.
Donald Sutherland does the pickpocketing, then Sean Connery turns up behind him and says, "Nice pull."
Yeah.
And then he's in. He's recruited.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same. And I'm just wondering if Soderbergh et al. Had sort of seen this as an influence. Because it's a very similar film.
It's likely, isn't it? Because I always think that if I was to ever... be deluded enough to think I was clever enough to do a complex heisty film, surely what you do is look at kind of your top 10 and go, "Oh yeah, well that's a cool little bit."
Absolutely.
So it's very possible.
Mm.
And this would have to be kind of one of your top your top 20 kind of.
Oh, I agree. It's got everything. It's got the sort of the. It's got the good close hand stuff like pickpocketing and picking locks. It's got the tension of trying to steal the keys. It's got the nice comedy moments.
Yeah.
It's got the physical dexterity where he's climbing on the train. It's got people squeezing into confined spaces like a coffin.
Yeah.
It's got all of that cool stuff which has been borrowed by things like Ocean's 11.
And I really like how this movie just gets straight into it.
Yeah.
There's very little mucking around.
Yeah.
Even, you know, introducing the characters is advancing the plot. There's no... There's a few sort of talky bits that...
Very little. That's more like playfulness between Pierce and Miriam, where she doesn't know if she can trust him or not.
Or Pierce and the daughter of...
We'll get onto that.
Yeah, yeah. That's very good.
But the other thing I like about it is there's no baggage.
Mm.
They are basically thieves who want the money.
Yeah.
And yet they still bring us along for the ride. We still want them to succeed.
They're not doing it because of some childhood revenge.
Yeah, or they're jealous because he stole my wife. Or he's a bad man, so it's okay to steal from you.
Yeah.
They're just thieves. They're stealing from money that's going to soldiers fighting in a war. Yeah. And we still want them to succeed.
And they do some very, amoral sort of things throughout
they
the whole
certainly do
including murdering one of their compatriots. Just goes to show, you know, how the charm of Sean Connery can really carry
it
on.
The immorality of it is refreshing. We're supporting the baddies for no other reason than we want them to steal some money.
And we
talked about this with Death Trap, where that didn't really pay off, where they're just nasty people who want it for themselves, but you couldn't really like them for it. But with this, it's the polar opposite. We love them. I really, really like the characters in this.
And is that, do you think, because the other so-called respectable members of society who are portrayed in this are just made to look like such sort of hypocritical...
Possibly.
Just vain fools.
That is maybe the purpose of the gentleman's club scene, because they're a bunch of arseholes and they deserve to get... They don't deserve to get ripped off, but they had it coming.
These guys are cleverer, they're cooler, they've got a plan.
Yeah.
So Sean Connery's character has already sort of said to Miriam... Basically, that we've got to find what their weaknesses are.
Yes.
Kent and Fowler's weaknesses. Mm. No respectable gentleman is that respectable.
So, good line.
Yeah.
So the first one is Trent, who is the
bank... Trent, not Kent, sorry.
Trent is the bank president. And he appears to be squeaky clean. He's that respectable gentleman. Miriam tries to seduce him by dressing up as a blonde lady of the night.
Yeah.
That she'd have kept her ordinary hair. I think he'd have fallen.
I know, she looked
very fetching.
Yeah, very.
But he doesn't like that kind of thing. But they very quickly establish that he's got these two small dogs, little terriers. He's a ratter.
He's a ratting man.
He's a ratting man, yeah. So they follow him to this sort of underground tavern.
A ratting pit.
Yeah, a ratting pit hosted by Brian Glover who improves everything. Love Brian Glover.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get this really unsettling scene where they chuck one of the dogs in and he just tears some rats to pieces. I'm guessing no rats were harmed in the making of this. Very much like no chickens were harmed in the train scene.
Mm.
But it's very convincing.
I rewound this a couple of times as well just to see, is he actually biting? It's kind of hard to tell if he's actually...
He's doing that dog shaking his head thing with toys.
It's hard to tell if they're already dead rats or just toy rats.
You do see one of the rats fall over.
Yeah.
Presumably he was drugged or something, or just a bit tired. But it's very well done. So I'm guessing it was he could eat 10 rats in 3 minutes or something. There's like a challenge. How many rats could you eat in a minute or whatever?
Yeah, so
like
apparently...
cream crackers or something.
I read a bit about it because I was sort of like, ratting. You might have two dogs and 100 rats, and it might be whose dog... eats the most, or it's basically whose dog can eat the most rats, or kill the most rats.
Yeah. The thing that alarmed me was, did you get Wurzel Gummidge out here?
Yeah, we,
because I know it was eventually made in New Zealand.
Yeah,
but,
we love Wurzel Gummidge, yeah.
Because the Crowman's dog was called Ratter, and that now disturbs me, because does that mean that the Crowman would go to one of these underground bars and let his dog chew up rats?
Oh, I hope not. I just hope that the dog would eat a stray rat that came onto their property.
Let's hope
and,
so. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think the
only if he had his ratting head on.
Yeah, exactly.
So after the rat annihilation, Sean Connery and Trent have a chat about him being unmarried.
Mm.
So I'd like to be married. And the next thing you know, he's been set up with Trent's daughter, and he's talking about Cox with Miss Moneypenny from Never Say Never Again.
I have passed many pleasant hours here, watching the workmen fit each piece into its precise slot.
They screw it together, do they?
Long bolts fitted tightly.
I just returned from America, a country of many prominent erections.
It is exciting to see things come together, so long as the quality does not suffer.
Tight-fitting joints, that's the secret.
So rare these days.
Depends on the skill of the workman, of course.
And he must have the proper tools.
It's unbelievable.
And then he goes off for a little promenade and stops to do some...
dry humping.
I mean, the sight of Sean Connery dressed in Victorian finery, pelvic thrusting is...
He's blaming it on the good times in Glenn and Boogie, like Big Fun used to do.
It's damn funny. And these are double entendre that would make James Bond blush, really.
I thought I was watching a Carry On film for that brief moment. I'll hasten to add, when I used to watch the ITV version, I don't think this scene was in it.
Yeah, okay.
Because it is just 3 minutes of smut.
And is it just me or... does the daughter look older than the mum?
Well, was that intentional? Because he's talking to the mum.
Yeah.
And they're talking filth. Mm. And they're obviously getting on famously. And she looks quite young. Yeah. Was the intention to make you think that that was her? And then the older-looking daughter ends up and goes, oh, hello?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I know the daughter's supposed to be just boring and frumpy and unattractive and everything that Sean Connery wouldn't want. But, yeah, I kind of... when the two of them were together, I was like... I'm sure she looks about 5 or 6 years older than the mum, but yeah, that could have very well been the point.
And I think this is another thing, as well as the smut, this is a good scene which shows that Sean Connery's got quite a light touch when it comes to comedy. Not talking about cocks, but when he takes the biscuit.
Yeah.
She offers him a biscuit, he goes, oh, with gratitude. And the expression on his face is fantastic.
And even some of the physical stuff with the mother trying to fill his cup of tea with the pot and he keeps sort of leaning away.
Yeah.
And I actually think this film, for me, was a bit of a revelation for me. His comedic timing and his comedic delivery. Mm. I mean, it's always been there with Bond and, you know, with other things, this kind of wryly arched eyebrow and making a kind of arch comment, but... he is just so funny in this film.
Yeah, I think he's great.
He is brilliant in this film. And, you know, perhaps there was more comedy gold out there to be mined for Sean Connery.
It was very shortly after this that he turned into the kind of the elderly sage, almost like the bearded Yoda who will turn up in things like Untouchables or even like Red October.
Highlander. Yeah.
He's the one who turns up and goes, oh, I'm going to teach you lessons about life.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how he went on until his retirement.
With a little blip playing Catherine Zeta-Jones' 70-something-year-old boyfriend.
Yeah.
When she was in her 30s.
He's courting young Miss Trent. And they go horse riding together, and he lays on the charm pretty thickly about a certain young lady that I'm interested in, and through that conversation she reveals that the key is hidden in the wine cellar. She says, "Oh, father must be getting nervous before each shipment because he goes down and has a little tipple in the wine cellar." So he puts two and two together and realizes that the key's in the wine cellar.
Yeah,
so they stage a break in.
Yep,
by just because one of the staff leaves the door open. So they sneak in.
It was quite easy, that break-in, wasn't it? Miriam just sort of, excuse me, sir, knocks on the door.
Yeah. You just open the door for 10 minutes.
Yeah. It's like, did the Smiths live here or something? Yeah. Like, no.
They don't. Yeah. So they sneak in, and under the cover of the women playing dueling pianos, they go and they get the key.
Yeah.
Job done. Bang.
Yeah.
Nice and easy.
Yep.
So they have to then move on to chapter 2, which is the second key, which Fowler, one of the bank employees, has already revealed is round his neck and he never takes it off.
Yeah.
Pierce goes to the bank to talk to Fowler. We learn very straight away that Fowler is basically a sex pest. He's a horrible, horrible man.
He's
awful.
Very grotty man.
We get some smuts where he's eyeing up the lady customers and he's talking about withdrawals and deposits.
Yeah.
Schoolboy stuff.
He's the Harvey Weinstein of Victorian era bank managers.
Yes.
Yeah.
they play to this and they dress Miriam up as would it be like a courtesan, a French companion,
a little dash of trollop thrown in for good measure.
Yep. Yeah. She does an a low voice.
Yeah.
And she lures him and he's immediately taken by saying she's not at all bad for a foreign woman. This man is a swine. Mm. The other thing I noticed about this is Sean Connery keeps saying in it at the end of everything. He goes, oh, she's a fine woman, in it.
is he supposed to be affecting a Cockney accent?
I think
it?
So.
Ah.
But he just sounds like some sort of modern-day teenager on a council estate, like Vicky Pollard or something.
It's about as good as his Russian accent in Hamburg October.
She's a fine woman, in it.
Mm.
Well, he stages a meeting between Miriam's French lady, which is basically, it's a brothel.
Yeah.
And she's gonna surrender herself to him. That's their plan. Mm-hmm. Is while he's stripping off, they steal his key.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to take her clothes off. He's virtually naked. She manages to get the key off. They copy it in time. They stage a police raid or something.
Yeah.
So nothing actually happens, or it comes close to that.
Yeah. They're good at staging things in this.
They are film. Very good. It's like The Sting.
Yeah.
Actually. It's very reminiscent of The Sting.
That's what it reminded me of. When I was trying to think of sort of heist films which are a bit cleverer than you.
Yes.
And you're always.
Sting's perfect.
Sting is perfect. But I think The Sting just is. The Sting is perfection, really, as a film.
Yeah.
And it just does it a little bit. Very clever. Yeah. Very, very clever.
But we get more knob gags. They say things like, she holds a very rigid standard.
Yeah.
And she says, I will take care of every big thing. The feel of flesh on flesh. And he says, is that the French way? Well, how else are you going to do it?
Yeah. Oh, well.
He does keep his long johns on, I suppose.
Mm, but... maybe his top hat on. I mean,
It is worth mentioning here, I don't know how much research you've done, and I'm not going to go into details, but this scene in the book is much more sinister.
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk about why. Or if we do, I'm going to edit it out.
Okay.
Because it's fucking horrible.
Have you read the book?
No, I did it on Wikipedia, so I don't need to read the book. In the book...
Oh, Michael Crichton.
That's horrible, isn't it?
This may be period accurate, Michael, but that's just yuck, mate.
So big ups for actually... making it a bit more farcical in the film,
because
you'd have been lucky with an 18 certificate.
Well, just tonally, that would have really...
You wouldn't be rolling in the aisles with that one, would you?
You would have been sitting there with a smile on your face throughout the whole film, and then all of a sudden
you'd just be crying. Mm. But luckily, Michael Crichton was hopefully advised to say, no, you can't do that, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Crichty, just do it this way. And it works. It's fun and it's funny. A little bit sinister.
Yeah.
But anyway, we now have the second key.
Mm.
So we move on to the third and fourth chapter, because we're after two keys at the same time,
mm-hmm.
Which we know are in a cabinet in a guard's office at the train station.
Yeah.
So they stake out the train station. And the only time they can ever access it is when the night watchman goes for a piss.
Yeah.
He drinks his beer. That's my Donald Sutherland accent. Mm. He drinks his beer and he goes off to the toilet, and they have 75 seconds in order to actually run in there, get the keys, copy them.
That's 75 seconds. That's impressive. You know, if the train guard was played by my 70-year-old father, they'd have quite a lot more than that. Put it this way.
Yeah, if it was me getting up in the morning.
12 to 13 minutes. You know.
Could actually cut the keys while you were in there. Yeah. But they have this 75 seconds. They can't get the keys in daylight. They do a little test where a small boy, a gutter snipe, runs through and tries to steal them.
Yeah.
And Donald Sutherland learns that he's his son. They should have got Kiefer in, shouldn't they, really? That would have been a nice little twist. He'd have been about that age.
Creepy little kid that he would have been.
Horrible, yeah. Yeah. He'd have gone, copy that. And he'd have run in and killed everyone and took the keys. So they have to do this run. So in other words, they need somebody... to get in there and break in so Donald Sutherland can run in, copy the keys, and run back out again.
They need a cat burglar.
They need a cat burglar.
Yeah.
So they choose, and here's the next smut, they need Clean Willy.
Clean Willy,
Played by Wayne Sleep. Were you aware of Wayne Sleep before
this? No, I wasn't.
He's an award winner. He's got for decades a top ballet dancer.
Oh, wow.
And he was hired for this for his athletics.
I'm not surprised he wasn't hired for his acting ability.
No, he's not that good.
But yeah, there are some impressive.
And he did all that himself because they couldn't get a small enough stuntman, so he had to do it all himself. So he is the one who's scaling the walls.
That's a cool scene as well. So they
brilliant.
They stage. Oh no, it's during a public execution, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there's a public execution that they use as a distraction from Clean Willy doing this cool.
The breakout escape. Of Newgate Prison is brilliant. Yeah. He scales well. He hangs onto those spikes.
Yeah.
And I remember this from watching it as a kid, and it really went through me. You see the blood trickling down his hands. And he did all that himself. That was Wayne Sleep climbing up that wall.
Oh, very
and it was
impressive.
Quite a hot property. He had his own TV show, The Hot Shoe Show.
Oh.
A show about dancing, which he used to do with Bonnie Langford.
Yeah.
I've seen Wayne Sleep.
Did he know you were in the bedroom watching him?
Hi, Wayne. No, I saw him in a West End production of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. He played the child catcher.
Oh, good.
He was very sinister.
Yeah.
Wow. I took Jess to see that for Valentine's Day many years ago.
And then you afterwards went into his hotel room and watched him sleep?
Yeah, I watched Wayne sleep.
Yeah.
It was very nicely done, yeah. But do you know who played Karatekus Potts when I saw Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
Oh, who?
Jason Donovan.
Fantastic.
Brilliant. But Clean Willy's broken out of Newgate Prison.
Hey.
I
love the scene though when Pierce is sort of walking to, is he talking to Clean Willy's, is it his mum or his wife? Or
I think it's his lady.
His
friend.
Lady.
Yeah.
And he's heading down these kind of, looks like Nocturne Alley from Harry Potter, and this old crone comes towards him and he just bashes her. I think it's supposed to be a man pretending to be a crone, but it's never made clear.
No. So just... he goes to see the lady of the night, Victor Meldrew's neighbour from One Foot in the Grave. She used to be married to Angus Deaton in One Foot in the Grave.
Brilliant.
And she says, you know, tell Clean Willy to break out. Yeah. Now, she's Clean Willy's girlfriend, and she's up to that when he's not there.
Yeah.
His Willy is going to be anything but clean.
Well, I hope... It's
filthy Willy.
Yeah, it'll be a mucky, mucky
Scabby Willy.
Yeah. Get a topical cream on that Willy.
Ooh. But he breaks out, and it's awesome.
It's great.
It's a really good breakout scene.
Cool scene, yeah.
So then we see Donald Sutherland doing some really crap practicing to get the key.
Mm.
So he, rather than go into an area which is the right sort of dimensions, like running along the ground and running up some steps, he just runs on the spot.
He runs on the spot.
You're never going to do that properly.
No.
But he manages to do it in 74 seconds.
Mm.
So they're good to go. The heist is on. So we get another really cool scene where Clean Willy is scaling the station of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
He gets through this tiny little skylight and opens the door for Agar. So the Night Watchman goes for his piss. Agar does the running in. Why does Agar need to do it? If Clean Willy's already in there,
why doesn't he do it?
Why didn't he just open the cabinet and copy the keys and get out again?
Contractual obligation to have Donald Sutherland in the scene? I don't...
It's for viewer suspense, obviously.
Yeah.
But we go. And so Donald Sutherland runs, and they're counting along. One. Two.
Mm.
It's not a second each time.
No.
Three. But he just managed... There's a lot of keys. He's dropping the keys. He's copying them. And he managed to get back in 74 seconds.
My takeaway from that scene was how soothing it is hearing Sean Connery whisper numbers to you.
I could go to sleep on that.
72.
It's lovely. Yeah.
73. 74.
Mm, I'd be gone by 75. Yeah,
should really do an audio thing for insomniacs. 82. Are you still awake? That's amazing. No one's ever gone this far before. 83.
You
come
must
on.
Have a most prominent erection.
You must be sleepy now.
but according to the narrative, he manages to do it in 75 seconds. But like I said, because I'm such a sad prick, I timed it, and it was actually 136 seconds.
Oh, it was 136 seconds.
Yeah, I timed it. Because I'm a sad prick.
Yeah. It's like that scene in a movie, though, you know, every bad action movie has it where...
With the bombs counting down.
Yeah, or the tsunami or the train or something is, you know, 500 metres away and it just doesn't move for
like Lancelot in
seconds.
Holy Grail.
Yeah.
But he's running towards the screen all the time, yeah.
Yeah.
So we now have the four keys.
Mm.
It's good.
Mm-hmm.
So the next thing is to actually get on the train. So what they do is, of course, they bribe the train guard, Michael Elphick, and say, we're going to come on the train and we're going to have... Well, we think they're going to steal the girl, but he's just gone on to have a look.
Yeah.
Donald Sutherland goes on the train with a baboon, I think, doesn't he? He's like a monkey handler. Mm. He's got an eye patch and he's handling a monkey on the train, not literally, just to see that he can open the safe door. So we see him put the four keys in and we think, oh, great, he's going to steal the girl.
Yeah.
But it's the wrong week and it's just... Maps and parcels and things in there and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that game is on. We then hear the infamous line, Edward Pierce, Sean Connery says, what could go wrong?
Yeah.
Well, I'll never say that.
I'll tell you what would go wrong. Clean Willy get bloody caught.
Clean Willy gets pinched by the crushers.
He does.
Which sounds very painful.
And he squeals like a stool pigeon.
Because I don't want to go back into the chokey. Please, mister.
All I know is that he's a cracksman planning a real flash pull, he is. It was this point where I realised that this performer had not been hired for his acting ability.
It's quite a... And imagine the other takes. That's the one they used. Yeah. So, yeah, Clean Willy's grasped him up good and proper.
Yeah. They do a little sting where they then try and...
Oh, because he writes to him, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So Clean Willy writes to him and says, we must meet at the flower show.
Yeah, and they try and trap Pierce, but Pierce smells a whiff of something afoul.
He smells some crushes.
Maybe it's Willy isn't so clean anymore.
Yeah.
And he sort of tells him, you know, if you've stitched me up, you'll be sleeping with the fishes, or you'll be in lavender. Or,
He says, I haven't, Mr. Because he calls himself John Sim.
Yeah,
the actor from the lakes. Yeah. So, but of course, Pierce realizes that Clean Willy has stitched him up good and proper.
Mm.
Clean Willy does a runner. Pierce goes after him. Yeah. This is another brilliant,
really good scene. Yep,
a great chase through those streets of London.
Mm-hmm. Great period detail again.
Yep, it's good camera work.
Yeah,
it looks handheld. He's following Clean Willy through these narrow alleyways.
Mm. Great finish.
It's really dark. Willy thinks he's got away.
Yep,
and then he hears this boom. Boom, 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 on the stairs, and it's a ball falling down the stairs. So it's that double whammy that, yep, like the cat scare basically in horror movies.
And then he's so relieved when he sees it's a ball.
Yep.
For about a second.
Yep. And then the other guy who doesn't get much screen time, who's like Connery's chauffeur.
Yeah, he's Pierce's sort of valet or something.
Yeah.
And he's just like, yeah, I'm in from the start. That's really. Right.
he then puts his hand around the window and chokes Clean Willy to death and just leaves him there.
Chokes the Willy.
Have you ever choked Willy through the window?
Sounds a bit risky. So Willy's been well and truly choked. And I did think that was quite a dark scene as well. I was kind of, ooh.
As a child, that is the other scene I remember with such clarity, because it frightened me.
Yeah.
The being choked behind the window. And I always thought it was Sean Connery that did it. Because it's a tall man with a beard. Everyone's a tall man next to Wayne Sleep, because he's tiny.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's the valet, isn't it?
He had a top hat on too.
Yes. Which,
you know, I've never seen so many top hats as I have in this movie.
I haven't seen this many top hats. Gangs of New York is probably the only rival for big silly stovepipe hats.
Yeah, you're right. The camera work, actually, I was impressed throughout this whole film. It's a very mobile camera. It's always kind of moving.
Yes.
And I just kind of thought, in terms of the actual direction of the film, it's the lighting or something that just lets it down. Sometimes there's this little lack of atmosphere.
Mm.
They've got the costumes perfectly done. They've got the set is just looking really ideal.
Yeah.
The movement of the camera is fine, but it just has this kind of flat...
It feels a little staged, I suppose.
Stagey. And I think it's the lighting or something. Mm.
Need a better gaffer.
Yeah.
But we're on to...
So Willy's dead.
Yep. And then the gold people, I think one of them's called Sharp, who's the guy who runs the train office, who played, I think he played Henry Tudor in the first ever Blackadder.
Yes.
Yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. Yep. He's walking with the guy from the hotel inspector in Fawlty Towers who sells outboard motors.
Yeah.
That's him. So they're walking and they're having a discussion about Sims after the gold.
Mm.
So they put extra steps in place to prevent the gold being taken, which is essentially a padlock.
It is a very big padlock.
Yeah, so that'll stop them. But they also say that nobody is allowed to ride in the carriage van.
Mm-hmm.
So Agar, he's listening in on this, goes back to Pierce and says, "Well, it can't be bloody done.
Mm.
It can't be bloody done.
It can't be done."
And Pierce's solution, which is something else I always remember, is find me a dead cat. Problem solved.
I did a double take at that line actually.
I loved that, and I still love it now, because that's one thing they don't reveal.
Are they going to try and swing it?
It's quite small in here, isn't it? Is he going to put it on his head?
I'm surprised it wasn't part of Agar's sort of preparations in the previous. You know, he's jogging on the spot. Wait, give me a dead cat.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, we can swing one here.
Is it going to double as Agar's moustache? Mm. Is it going to be Sean's new wig?
Yeah.
It would be better than the current one.
What? Is it going to double as Sean Connery's chest hair?
I don't think it's needed. There's enough on there anyway. But that's the plan. The next thing you see then is it's robbery day. The train's about to go. The gold is loaded up. And Miriam, the mistress of disguise, turns up as a mourning lady with a coffin.
Yeah.
The coffin is to go in the luggage van. But of course, under the new rules, she's not allowed to travel in there. There's a pretty gruesome scene where the bell rings. They've got a belfry on top, which is, for people who are afraid of being buried alive, they can ring the bell.
Mm.
The bell starts ringing, and she's saying, "Oh, he's been dead a week with cholera." And there's a horrible stench, which is, of course, the dead cat.
Yeah.
They open the coffin, and this terrified me as a child as well. Donald Sutherland has got this big tongue sticking out and a bright purple face, and his eyes open, which are moving slightly, but they're open, and so he's obviously dead. They've very cleverly proven that there's nothing untoward in the coffin.
Yeah.
By revealing the corpse themselves.
Sort of plausible deniability.
That's the one.
And he's sort of green. He's kind of got a Herman Munstery green.
Yeah.
He's paint on his face for the rest of the movie.
Bit of face paint on him, yeah.
Yeah.
So That's it. The plan's in. So the coffin goes into the mail carriage, and so Pierce and Miriam are about to go into a first class carriage. But of course, Fowler the sex pest turns up.
Mm.
He's riding on the train too. Luckily, he doesn't recognise Miriam as being the French courtesan, but he is immediately taken with her.
Mm.
So Connery sees this as his opportunity. They sit together. So there's a diversion, and he can continue with the robbery while they're sitting together in another carriage. So he can travel alone.
Yeah,
which makes it easier for him to continue with the robbery. And then we get quite an unpleasant scene in the carriage with Fowler and Miriam, where he tries to violate her once more by saying, "Have you ever heard of the 50-mile-an-hour club? It's very beneficial to the circulation." And she's, "Oh, you are an awful man." She turns into Barbara Windsor, basically. "Oh, you are awful." But he tries it on with her. There's this strange conversation about men giving a lady a token.
Yeah.
Which is obviously street slang for a John paying a prostitute. Mm. And I'd like to give you a token right now. What, in here? And he's trying it on with her, and she's smacking him about the face.
It's funny you should mention Barbara Windsor. There was a Carry On movie sort of marathon on, I think it was Comedy Central, over the weekend.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Bernard Breslau, as we...
Oh.
Yeah, our Krull callback to our Krull pod.
Ignorance. Yep.
But, yeah. They have not aged well.
I haven't seen a Carry On film for ages.
As you'd imagine.
Mm. We should do one for this.
We should, actually.
We could.
Yeah.
Yeah, we might do that later on, yeah.
And the actual robbery is very cool, too.
Really cool.
Really cool.
So, at the same time, Agar is released from the coffin by Michael Elphick.
Mm-hmm.
We see the dead cat in the coffin, poor thing. And he starts about opening the safe, getting the gold out, and replacing it with lead shot. So when it's taken off, it weighs the same, and there's no, oh my god, it's been stolen, which is they're going to die of lead poisoning, but never mind.
Hope they don't bury their cat in a pit cemetery.
This is like the Bond's 20th anniversary. We're just calling
I'm just doing callbacks to all our podcasts here. Can we get a big bus reference in there somewhere?
Probably some broken candles in there somewhere. But at the same time, Sean Connery is climbed to the top of the train.
Yeah.
In some amazing shots.
And even the bit before he actually climbs on, when he's just hanging off the side.
Yeah.
I mean...
And it's him.
Oh yeah, I can't see any... When he's on the top of the train, I was looking for harnesses or...
No.
I know he's holding that bit of rope, but...
But there's a couple of shots from behind the head where it's clearly a stuntman.
Mm.
But most of it, it's full on. You can see it's him doing it. It's too early for CG.
Yep.
It's definitely not back rear projection.
No.
It's him doing it. And he gets incredibly close to tunnels and those signal markers.
Yeah.
He gets knocked out by one of the signal markers when he's hanging off the train. And that's him as well.
Yeah.
And he's walking across this train. I read that he got really pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
Because when he signed up for it, they said, oh, the trains won't go any faster than 30 miles an hour. He was convinced they were going faster.
Mm.
And they were actually going about 70.
Wow.
And he was walking on top of them.
Yeah.
A 47-year-old man.
I know, it's better than anything he ever did as Bond, isn't
it? Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing sequence. But he goes along. He nearly gets killed a few times going under tunnels, and he gets smoke in the face and all this sort of stuff. But then he manages, with the aid of ropes, he's hanging off the back of the parcel carriage, picks the lock, and he's in. They throw the gold out to the murderous valet, and then he has to get back. But of course, his clothes are dirty.
Yeah,
his clothes are covered in... This is where we get more smut.
Mm.
His clothes are covered in smuts from the steam. And so he has to take Agar's clothes.
For someone who has methodically planned out this kind of foolproof heist plan, to not work out that his clothes would get dirty clambering all around a train.
Well, you if you don't keep an eye on the little things,
especially
if you just focus on the big things, something's going to get missed.
He's obviously a clothes horse, you know. I mean, you think he would have been concerned about such things. So,
but luckily Agar's quite tall,
mm-hmm.
which is probably why Donald Sutherland was hired.
Yeah. Not broad, though, is he?
No, which... They come a cropper with later.
Yeah.
So he takes Agar's dead man's suit, which stinks of dead cat, leaving Agar in a lovely, lovely red set of long johns to return back to the coffin. So he climbs back, gets in the carriage just before it arrives at Ashurst, so nobody sees him riding on the train to avoid suspicion. So he's in, he cleans his face, it arrives at Folkestone. Success! The gold's off the train, they've done it unnoticed. Then he gets off the train at Folkestone, does his jacket up, and we hear this tiny little tearing sound.
Yeah.
And of course, that's when we realise that Agar isn't as broad as Pierce, and he's ripped the whole back seam of his suit. leaving him very open to scrutiny.
I was hoping it was just a hernia or something. But no.
Just the tape on his wig.
Yeah.
See it flapping about at the side like Bobby Charlton. But that's the giveaway.
Yeah.
He's then spotted by various members of the banking community as being Sims. And they say, arrest that man! He tries to make a getaway and is arrested.
Mm-hmm.
We then go straight to a quite amusing courtroom scene.
Yeah.
Where he just takes the piss out of the judge. And the audience, the viewing gallery, just love him. He's this cheeky toff.
He's sort of become a folk hero almost.
Yes,
or something, hasn't he?
And they say, well, Mr. Pierce, you knew it was wrong to do so. So why did you do it? And he just says, because I wanted the money. And the audience just piss themselves. They say, he'll do 20 years for that. But in real life, I think Edward Pierce did 2 years. Whereas people like the train guard, Burgess, they were shipped to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So Pierce got off quite lightly, possibly because of his standing in the community.
Bit of classism going on there. Yeah.
He got 2 years and everyone else. Except Agar, who was the one who turned evidence, he shopped them all.
Yeah.
He was about to be sent to Australia and he turned evidence and said, well, no, if you let me go, I'll tell you everything. And that's how they all got caught. But in this one...
They ended up with 91 kilos weight of gold, worth £12,000 at the time, about £1 million in today's money.
Very nice.
Mm. Little factoid there.
There we go. Thank you. That's very interesting. So we will do 20 for it. So we think it's going to go badly, that he's going to go to jail.
Mm.
There's a nice crowd outside supporting him. He's kissed by a rough-looking lady, by a harridan on the street, who, when she backs off, it's Miriam.
Oh, never saw that coming.
In another disguise.
Yeah.
And she has, while snogging him, she's passed a key or something to pick the handcuffs into his mouth. He picks the handcuffs. He has a really good bit of derring do, a nice roistering with the guards.
Yeah.
And Agar is driving the prison cart.
Yeah.
So Agar drives away, and Pierce just stands and does this really gallant wave at everybody on the way out.
It's like a subversion of the ending of On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah.
It's not Blofeld and Irma Bunt.
No. But he does this joyous smile, which is brilliant. Again, it shows his comedy chops.
Yeah, yeah.
Massive smile. And he's waving to everyone as they go away.
Yeah.
Movie ends. They've got away with it.
And everyone's just so thrilled for it. Yeah. For him escaping as well.
Yeah.
Totally, completely and utterly Hollywood sort of ending, really.
Yeah.
It's great.
Hooray, my brother's on the Russian front and he's not going to get paid for getting shot. Yay!
Yeah, he's a prick anyway. Steal his gold. Yay. Yeah.
But it's a very, very joyous ending. It's very satisfying.
It is. Incredibly satisfying.
They get away with it, which is always brilliant in a heist. The end.
Off to more adventures, as you kind of think. You know, it could be like a TV spin-off almost.
It would make a brilliant TV spin-off. But like Raffles, the Gentleman Thief.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Chris, need I ask, is this still any good?
Absolutely, definitely, yes. It's such good fun to watch. It's really joyous, really entertaining. But for me, the kind of the lighter farcical scenes, they sit really uncomfortably. The bawdy stuff. And then it mixes with somebody being strangled to death. And sometimes it sits a little bit uncomfortably. It's got so many good points to it. Anything with a complicated heist where you want them to succeed is always going to be good fun.
Yeah.
Even things like that Ben Stiller one, Tower Heist. It's not a very good film, but it's great fun to watch the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the better ones.
Yeah.
Not as good as The Sting, but definitely one of the top ones for this kind of movie. It's like we said before, Ocean's 11 has borrowed very, very heavily from stuff like this.
But I always feel like the Ocean's movies cheat a little bit in their heists. They don't quite make sense to me, a lot of them.
Particularly in 12 and 13.
Yeah, yeah.
The first one is quite satisfying.
Yeah.
It's you think they're going to lose, but that's part of
that's
the
plan.
That's
part of the plan, yeah.
Whereas with this one, you think they're going to lose, and they have to come up with a new plan. And I think that's much more satisfying. It's a lot less smug.
Yeah.
A lot more plus points. Jerry Goldsmith's score is brilliant. It's typical Jerry Goldsmith. It sounds like... You can tell it's him.
Yeah.
It's very similar to the one that we discussed previously, which was In a Space. Some of the other Spielberg-produced ones, it sounds very much like this. I watched The Burbs again the other day, and the music is very, very similar to this.
Mm.
It comes in with this jaunty, racy score, and it may as well say, you're going to have a good time.
Yeah, this is a jolly good caper ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is still good. How about you?
Oh, yeah, I really enjoyed it. Really, really enjoyed it. I agree with you on some of the tonal stuff. But actually, when I was watching it, I was reminded of Three Musketeers.
Yes.
Because again, it's that same sort of bit of action, real slapsticky comedy, and then some quite dark sort of stuff, like
a bawdy romp but with brutality.
With brutality, like I was thinking of the Four Musketeers when Raquel Welch's character gets throttled to death or something, you know, and it's just kind of like,
or with Christopher Lee's fighting with knives and he's cutting people.
Yeah. And so I was reminded of that kind of tone when I was watching this. But great performances from Connery and Leslie Ann Down. Sutherland kind of phoned it in a little bit. All the, as you've mentioned, the joys of a heist film where you're in on the plan, you kind of understand what's going on, there's all that tension and how they're going to do this, and really great fun watching how they execute it, and it kind of made sense. And I really, really enjoyed it. Loved the period detail. Thought it looked gorgeous. It's one of these ones that you watch and think, why hasn't some hack in Hollywood tried to remake this? Because there aren't a lot of Victorian era comedy action capers going around, unless you count sort of Sherlock Holmes films.
Yeah, or this was a couple of years before Young Sherlock Holmes, which is another one that I absolutely love.
Yeah.
And it horrifies me that it wasn't a major success.
Yeah.
Because it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And this has got that same... Obviously, Young Sherlock Holmes has got a much more polished feel because it costs a lot more, and it's got Spielberg and Barry Levinson onto it, so it looks a lot more. It was probably in Prague or something like that, but it's got that same kind of period feel to it.
Yeah.
And that same level of excitement and fun.
Yeah, with just a slightly bigger budget or something. I don't know what it was. There were just some moments where you look at it and go, God, they've got everything, as I've said before. They've got everything here, but it just doesn't sort of have that really high-end, big-budget kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
No, very, very good film. Yeah, I would almost like to see it remade, but they'll probably do something wanky, like a Kenneth Branagh, sort of Agatha Christie, CGI, overly polished.
It would be kind of so look. CG. It would have modern sensibilities.
Yeah.
Like the new Sherlock Holmes films do.
But
it would be interesting, because heist movies are fun. There's three really good character roles in this. Possibly four, if you count Clean Willy. it was great. I really enjoyed it.
Very good film. Yep, I agree.
So, I like talking about correspondence, because we had some again.
Ooh!
Yeah! Around about New Year, I think I had a couple of whiskies, and I posted on the Facebook and the Twitter, if any of our thousands of listeners had any films that they remember from their childhood and would like to be reviewed to see if they were still any good. And we got some nice responses.
Lovely.
I'll just read a couple. Some of them were on our list anyway, but there's some really nice ones. So thanks to everyone who's written in, and please continue to do so. Jules Lawrence from Brighton, England, suggested Hawk the Slayer, which I'm pretty sure is on our list anyway.
I think it was there,
So I think we'll definitely be looking at that. So thank you, Jules. Brian Rarare from Auckland suggested Kickboxer.
Yeah, I know Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Brian.
You know his brother.
I do know his brother, yeah. I know Brian's brother.
Kickboxer is a good one, actually.
I've never seen Kickboxer.
It's the original. Yeah, I'd like to do
I'm
that.
I'm happy to do it, yeah. Then we had Francesca Scalisi, who's from Alabama.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. Hello, Francesca. She suggested Return to Oz.
Brilliant.
Bloody brilliant suggestion.
Yeah, that really resonates for me. I'd love to do Return to Oz.
Yep. There, Andy Craig from Manchester, England, gave us a big list. Mm-hmm. Andy does a very good blog called Specky Eyes, if you ever want to have a look at that. It's really good.
You'd like that one.
I like Andy's, right? Yeah. Thanks a lot for that, yeah. he gave us a big list, including Explorers, which we talked about, but we went for Inner Space instead. Boys in Blue, nah. That's Cannon and Ball.
Yeah.
Nah.
Yeah.
That should be called Never Any Good.
Yeah.
War Games.
Yeah, I've got to be done.
Yeah.
Got to be done.
He suggested Cannonball Run 2, which I'm pretty sure Smirshpod are going to do at some point, because John Rain's always banging on about Cannonball Run 2.
Yeah.
Crime Wave, is that the Sam Raimi Coen brothers?
Yeah, that'll be that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Cat's Eye.
Oh, yeah.
Good day. Yeah. The Sure Thing.
Oh, who's that?
That's John Cusack, it's a Rob Reiner one.
Is that not the one? Is that the one where he holds up the stereo?
No, that's Say Anything.
Yeah.
Sure Thing is where he goes on a road trip with Tim Robbins to meet the Sure Thing.
He's
on a promise.
Yep.
But he rides with Daphne Zuniga,
who
they're the original Odd Couple. Will they get on or won't they? I remember it being okay. It's a good scene where they drink beer by stabbing it with a pen. It's good.
Princess Vespa from Spaceballs.
That's right. Okay. Stuart Cowan, my oldest friend, Stuart Cowan. From Coggleshall in Essex, suggested Don't Look Now.
Ooh.
Sorry, Stew Boy, it is still good.
It's a classic.
Yeah, I watched it a little while ago. It's bloody great. Sorry, mate. Rob Marlin from Switzerland suggested Dark Crystal.
Ooh, that's another potential.
And finally, Anne Coletta from Albany, New York, Clash of the Titans.
Oh, that's got to be done as
I
well.
I think this could keep us going for quite a while.
There's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot there.
If we do a listener's choice special every once in a while, who knows, we could get back to these people and ask them to write us an essay on how they remember it and how they like it. Maybe get them involved somehow. That could be fun.
Yeah, there are plenty. Thank you to all of those listeners who wrote in with their suggestions.
It is nice to know that we have listeners and they responded, so please continue to do so. It's just nice to hear from you.
Yeah, and some very good suggestions there.
So, speaking of suggestions, what are we doing next?
Well, we discussed, seeing as we enjoyed our Halloween and our Christmas specials so much, we talked about the possibility of doing a Waitangi Day.
Waitangi Day? What's that?
Waitangi Day commemorates the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi, which was a treaty signed between the Crown and various Māori chiefs of New Zealand. It is an important day for the country, where we talk about all sorts of kind of nebulous, wanky things like nationhood and what that means. And, you know, a day of protest and a day of celebration and a day off work. Yes, which is the most important thing to many of us. It's a public holiday. So we thought we would each do a Kiwi movie.
What have you chosen?
I've chosen and what is often distastefully referred to as New Zealand's most popular romantic comedy, Once We're Warriors.
That's going to have us rolling in the aisles, isn't it? Once We're
Warriors.
It
is.
Yeah, I've never seen Once Warriors. I know I should. It's one of the things they ask you when you apply for residency in New Zealand. Have you seen Once Warriors? I lied and I said yes.
Yeah.
So I'm here to right that wrong.
And directed by Lee Tamahori, who sort of went on to have semi-unsuccessful Hollywood career.
Yes, he did Die Another Day and... What's that Nicolas Cage one? Is it Next?
He did Next.
That's hilarious.
Which is a Michael Crichton book, actually.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And 6 Degrees of Michael Crichton. Yeah. And he also did...
He did one of those...
The Edge with Alec Baldwin and Anthony Hopkins, where they're sort of...
About you too.
Is it... he's amazing, Anthony Hopkins. Yeah. You know, he can embody anyone.
Put a hat on and he's there.
Alec Baldwin's Bono was a bit strange.
Yeah. Oh, that would be good. He also did one of the Alex Cross ones, didn't he? Along Came a Spider, which is all right.
Yeah. So he was a bit. He basically went off to Hackdom and did some hack work in Hollywood, but also launched the career of Temuera Morrison, who already had a successful career in New Zealand, but sent him off onto such things as Barbed Wire.
And Attack of the Clones. He's the original Stormtrooper.
It's because of this movie that all the Stormtroopers and Boba Fett are Māori.
That's right.
Yeah, and obviously just an important movie in terms of New Zealanders coming to terms with some of their social issues.
Okay. I've also chosen a film, because as a special we choose one each, and I've chosen a film that I remember being on TV when I was a boy. Another caper heist movie called Came a Hot Friday.
Really looking forward to that.
Directed by Ian Moon, who also directed the sequel to Once for Warriors.
What Becomes of the Broken Hearted.
So that's something I haven't seen for a very long time. So I'm saying we're doing it. I don't know if I can get a hold of a copy, but I'll certainly try. They'll probably have it in the DVD shop under New Zealand.
Yeah. Gee, the lengths we will go to watch a movie now.
Spending
actually
money.
Hire out a DVD.
Yeah. So for the rest of the world, we do have DVD shops in New Zealand. We still do, and they are still open for business. It's not all downloads and shit here. We actually have DVD shops.
I think they mainly survive on video games and things these days. Yeah.
And my children getting dollar DVDs out.
And illicitly selling weed from behind the counter.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
But so, yes, our Waitangi Day special will be next.
I look forward to it.
As do I.
Okay, I think we're done. We will see you folks next time, but we'll do our usual adverts. If you want to get in touch with us, and please do, you can reach us on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
We're on Facebook, StillAnyGood. And we also have an email address, which is StillAnyGood@gmail.com. It would be lovely to hear from you.
It would.
Okay, we're good. Thanks a lot, folks.
Thank you.
Have a happy new year, and we'll see you soon.
Bye now.
All I know is that he's a cracksman, planning a ring flash pull, he is.